stir up the gifts.
The Microsoft Corporation has a catchy new ad campaign. It's targeting its email and search engine rival, Google. You may have seen one of the commercials. They feature a technologically naive husband named Jeff, who keeps falling for fake advertisements in his Gmail inbox. According to his patient yet tech-experienced wife, these advertisements are a result of Google's guileful practices of reading Jeff's email in order to better target him with ads. This is a practice that the Microsoft company has dubbed as being Scroogled, or screwed by Google, for those of you who have not had your coffee. For instance, one night after work, Jeff's wife looks over his shoulder and reads on his laptop, "Full service bankruptcy." "Is there anything you need to tell me, Jeff?" she asks. "No, these ads just started showing up." And after Jeff's wife gives him a primer on the competitor's practice of invading his privacy, they look to see why in God's name they would send him an advertisement about bankruptcy. It was found in an email that Jeff received from a friend that read, "Hey Jeff, I've been to that new pie place so many times that we might have to take out a second mortgage." To this, the commercial declares, "That's all it takes to get Scroogled." Let me say from the outset that I do not have a horse in the Microsoft Google beef. I use both services every day and would welcome a generous donation to Harvard's Memorial Church from either one. Bill Gates, Larry Page, holler at me. But though I will admit, I kind of like the verb Scroogle. More importantly, I like what it captures and what it conveys. The perils and pitfalls which come from reading someone else's mail out of appropriate context, and then coming to a misguided conclusion about the person's life and intent. For too often, this is what we, as modern interpreters of the Bible, do, particularly with Paul's correspondence. We Scroogle the Apostle Paul. We read his writings out of their appropriate historical and cultural context with our own personal agendas in mind. This is why, more than any other text in the Bible, Paul's letters to the churches along Asia Minor and pastoral letters to Timothy and Titus have been used to justify oppression of minoritized members in our churches, and thus screw over the most vulnerable in our community. Consider the serpentine system of slavery. Paul, in his ancient context, took slavery for granted. He ordered the fugitive Onesimus to return to his slaveholder Philemon. And Paul even writes to Titus, "Tell slaves to be submissive to their masters and to give them satisfaction in every respect. Never talk back. Tell them never to pilfer, but to show complete and perfect fidelity." It is no wonder that 1,800 years later, when our nation went to war over slavery, Confederates held the gun in one hand and the Bible in the other. For there were those who saw it as their biblical mandate to uphold America's peculiar institution. Paul's cultural worldview was more important than the humanity of 4 million enslaved people in this nation. Consider the silencing of women. Paul writes to Timothy that women should learn in quietness and full submission. Women were not permitted to teach or assume any authority over a man, according to the pastoral epistles. Women must sit down and remain silent. And beginning in the second century, these texts were scrutinized by interpreters as outright prohibitions against female leadership. True. A woman's quote-unquote place in the first century was care and cultivation of the home. That was the context. But we also must remember that Paul organized the earliest churches within homes. This explains his close relationship with women such as Phoebe, Chloe, Lois, and Eunice. Many who were wealthy widows who not only were spiritual leaders in their community, but often paid Paul's bills. For it seems that the practicalities of pecuniary concern would even trump Paul's own sexist prohibitions. And consider the shaming of same-sex love. People cite Paul's writing in Romans and Corinthians as prohibitions against homosexuality, a word that was not even invented until sometime in the 19th century. Same-sex relationships in ancient Rome, like most relationships at the time, were premised on dominance and submission. Roman men were free to conquer other men without the loss of their social standing and masculinity, as long as the men were socially appropriate submissives. That is to say, slaves, male prostitutes, and pederasty relations that often bordered on pedophilia. The victimization of the most vulnerable. So beyond having no biological concept of what we now know scientifically about same-sex desire, Paul could not have imagined what a healthy, non-abusive, mutually fulfilling, consensual same-sex relationship could have looked like. In fact, Paul could probably not have imagined what a healthy, non-abusive, mutually fulfilling, consensual relationship among the opposite sexes would have looked like. This may be why he encouraged everyone to remain single like him. But my point, brothers and sisters, is that if you and I look to Paul for advice on a wide range of contemporary matters, matters that Paul would have had no conception of in his ancient world, we will be guilty of scrutiny. We will be reading his mail and then making wild and irresponsible judgment calls today, totally out of context. But this is not to say, however, that Paul does not have something to teach us this morning. He does. And I believe it is found in the opening greeting of this, his second letter to his ministerial protege, Timothy. We first meet Timothy in the book of Acts when members of the church of Lystra recommend Timothy to Paul as a faithful and upstanding leader. Paul proceeds to take Timothy on his subsequent missionary journeys. Paul loves him like a son. He gives Timothy charge over the church in Ephesus. And now Paul writes Timothy this final letter of instruction and encouragement from inside a Roman jail. Paul has some things on his mind. Some things on his mind and heart that come through even in the letter's greeting. It has to do with the future of the faith. Paul is anxious. The fledgling Christian community is at an impasse. In the seventh decade of the Common Era, Timothy represents the third generation of Christians, and there are cultural pressures on every side. And just like any aging charismatic leader, Paul is concerned with the bureaucratizing and thus maintaining the Christian community writ large beyond his death. Paul, he regards Timothy as essential to the church's future. His grandmother Lois and his mother Eunice were a part of an intergenerational community that promoted moral habits and character traits that are now evidenced in Timothy. And all of us here to some extent are products of our moral environment. This is what Paul is celebrating about Timothy. He's celebrating Timothy by celebrating his grandmother and mother and the larger church in Lystra. For he understands that moral character and cultivation always take place in a community context. This is why it's important for us always to assess and reassess what values we are sowing into the ground for subsequent generations. We love to cite the African proverb, "It takes a village to raise a child." Yet we never stop to consider whether or not the village is crazy. For crazy villages raise crazy children. Just as kind, compassionate, gracious, and loving communities raise kind, compassionate, gracious, and loving children. In fact, according to recent findings, we see that intergenerational involvement reinforcing the moral character and discipline habits as Lois, Eunice, and Paul did for Timothy may be the real key for future success. Last academic year, Cambridge Public Schools encouraged all parents to read Paul Tough's amazing book, How Children Succeed. In it, Tough argues that the cognitive hypothesis, which promotes the idea of measurable cognitive skills, such as IQ exams, that this may not be the best way to determine future educational and professional success. But rather, we ought to emphasize a different set of qualities, such as persistence, self-control, grit, and self-confidence. For these are all non-cognitive skills that you and I refer to as moral character. And because of Timothy's character, and because of the intergenerational context in which his faith was formed, Paul is encouraging him to take up the torch and run on in faith. Your grandmother may not be here for long, Timothy. Your mother will not be around forever. And this may be the last time that you hear from me. But neither fret nor be afraid, because God has put something down on the inside of you. Oh, I can feel Paul's concern for Timothy. Who among us has not watched someone close to us, whether it be a daughter or a son, a student or a younger colleague, step up and step out into the role that they have been preparing for with fear and trepidation? We know their anxiety when it's time for them to step up into leadership capacity, when it's time for them to fulfill the call that God has put on their life, the ways that they begin to second guess themselves. We know it because most of us have been there. I know this with my own children. For others of us, we feel like Timothy right now. We've earned the marks. We've honed our craft under the care and protection of a parent or a mentor. And now it's time for us to show and to prove. Residency is over. Law school has come to an end. Dating was one thing, but now I'm married. We've talked about being parents, but now I'm really a mother. I'm a father. What am I going to do? No matter how prepared we are, it's an understandable tendency to wrestle with the demons of self-doubt. No one among us ever achieves any accomplishment of import in life without first fighting back a spirit of fear. This reminds me of a lesson I attempted to pass on to my son a few years back. One thing, Memorial Church, that you may not know about me is that I spent the first half of my life on the football field. So you might imagine my enthusiasm when I discovered the Bobby Bonds Pre-K Bulldogs in Riverside, California, were in need of a coach. I realize now what my wife knew then: it was a bad idea. Imagine yours truly showing up with my intensity of a college football coach, my plays drawn up, headset on, rehearsed a number of inspirational speeches to discover a gang of five-year-olds who were mostly interested in who could drink their juice box the fastest. Anyway, on one Saturday morning, we were driving to the game. And my son confesses to me that he's a little scared. We were playing the best team in the league that morning, a team that I'm still convinced forged birth certificates to pass off teenagers as kindergartners. Daddy, I'm scared. They seem really good. To this I replied, "It's okay, son. There's no need to be afraid. You're prepared. You've worked hard. So just trust yourself and trust your teammates. Besides, you should know the difference, Elijah, between being scared and between being nervous. You should have butterflies in your stomach. That means you care. But once you get on that field and you start the game, your nerves will disappear and your skill will shine through." Fast forward 1 hour. The Pre-K Bulldogs have warmed up. We went through our drills and we were on the sideline getting ready for the kickoff. "Come on, Bulldogs, bring it in." I begin my speech. "We're prepared. We're precise. We're proficient." I told you I had no business coaching five-year-olds. "Look over at them. You shouldn't be scared of them. They're scared of you. You have heart. They don't know about that. They're scared of you." To which my son raises his hand and says, Daddy, actually, they're probably nervous just like me." So though in a more effective manner, Paul is conveying this same advice to young Timothy. If you want to extend this ministry into the future, then you cannot be afraid. For God did not give us a spirit of fear, but rather a spirit of power and of love and of self-discipline. Paul impresses this point upon his beloved protege. God did not give you cowardice. God gave you character. In the face of life's obstacles, you need not despair. You have power and love and a sound mind poured into you by God through a nurturing community. The gift, it's already inside of you. It's just time for you now to stir it up. It's time for you now, Timothy, to shake it up. And for someone here under the sound of my voice, I want you to know this morning that this is what God wants for us. There are a host of obstacles that we must overcome. There are a number of social ills that we as a community of faith must confront. And there is no need for you and I this morning to look to someone else somewhere else. But rather, God is calling us to shake ourselves up. Like cleaning supplies in our cupboard. Some of us have been sedentary, sitting on our faith. And we have allowed God's active ingredient of faith, power, love, and self-discipline to sink down to the bottom of our souls. Thus, we are not making the impact that we could possibly be making in our community today. We're not having the import that we could be having in our world. We're wasting the gift that God has placed inside of us. But if you and I on today, like Paul is encouraging Timothy here, if we resolve ourselves to the fact that God has not given us a spirit of fear, then eyes have not seen and ears have not heard what God has in store for you and me. And then we can better appreciate the words of the 19th century clergyman Maltby Davenport Babcock. For he says, we are not here to play dream or drift. We have hard work to do. We have heavy loads to lift. But we now shall not shun the struggle, for it is God's gift. Be strong. This is our day, my friends, to stir up the gift that God has placed within us. Let the church say, amen.